It was Robert, William's elder brother, who took him to the pantomime, not because he wanted to take him there, but because he'd rashly promised to take him, and William ruthlessly held him to the promise. Robert made the promise in a moment of weakness on a blazing summer day when a Christmas pantomime seemed as remote as the millennium. Robert and Ethel were giving a tennis party, and William's services as ball boy had to be requisitioned for that afternoon. "And you," Robert had said imperiously, "will fetch the balls for us."
"Oh, will I?" said William.
"Yes, you will," said Robert firmly.
"Who's going to make me?" said William.
"I am," said Robert.
"All right, you make me then."
Robert reluctantly abandoned his imperious manner. "Now look here," he said in a man-to-man tone of voice. "You wouldn't like to sit by and watch us looking for our own tennis balls, would you?"
"Yes, I would,"
said William, unmoved by the pathos of this picture. Robert added a touch of indignation to his man-to-man manner. "Look, I'm sure you wouldn't like it to be said in the village that you'd simply sat by and let us fetch our own balls."
"Yes, I would,"
said William again. "Anyway, I wouldn't be sitting by. I'd be out playing with Ginger." Robert gave a terse laugh indicative of incredulity and disgust. "My dear boy, you surely couldn't go out to play with the free mind, knowing that there was no one here to help us."
"Yes, I could,"
said William firmly and without hesitation. There was a short silence. Both knew, of course, that William would eventually stay at home to be ball boy for the tennis party. It was simply a question of conditions. William broke the silence.
"Well, will you take me to the pantomime at Christmas?" he asked.
"Oh, yeah, certainly," said Robert carelessly. "And you'll be ready for work by 3?
"All right,"
agreed William. And now, in the last week of the Christmas holidays, Robert had no alternative but to take William to the pantomime. He did it without any unnecessary sociability, taking him straight there and straight back, sitting through the performance with an air of intense boredom and ostentatiously reading a volume of Chekhov's plays during the intervals. Whenever the comedians elicited a guffaw from him, he covered the slip as quickly as possible by intensifying the pained aloofness of his expression. To William, the afternoon was one of unclouded bliss. He laughed at the comedian so uproariously, he thought once or twice he must have broken a rib. He cheered the hero, he hissed the villain, he clapped and shouted applause long after everyone around him had stopped. And he fell in love with Princess Goldilocks, the heroine. Every smile she threw at the audience thrilled him. Every tone of her voice was music to him. He couldn't help thinking that his passion was returned, for she seemed to smile directly at him, to speak to him alone. As he followed the crowd out of the theatre, with Robert looking very stern, lest anyone should suspect he'd secretly enjoyed the show, William felt that all the rest of his life must be devoted to her service. There was no time to be lost. He must woo and win her as soon as possible. During the next few days, William seemed to those around him to be strangely quiet and docile. They couldn't know, of course, that in reality he was engaged in desperate adventures, fighting armies of brigands single-handed, storming rocky strongholds, killing ferocious beasts. These adventures always terminated happily, and the rescued Princess Goldilocks flung herself into his arms, sobbing out her gratitude and love. Then gradually William began to find these adventures unconvincing. They left him exactly where he was before. He must betake himself to the sterner staff of real life. He decided to walk to London, make his way into her room at the theatre, and ask her to marry him at once. He'd take some food with him and as much money as he could extract from his mother. Wearing an expression of almost painful virtue, he entered the drawing room where his mother and his sister Ethel sat over the fire doing needlework. "They say that an actress is staying at the Cedars," Ethel was saying as he entered.
"The Cedars, dear?"
said Mrs. Brown, vaguely.
"Yes, that place in Marley, they've turned into a hotel. You know, they've been advertising it a lot, old-fashioned Christmas and that sort of thing. She goes up every day to London for the show."
What show is she in?" asked Mrs. Brown.
"Oh, pantomime. The one that Robert took William to. She's Goldilocks or something."
What's the matter, William?" said Mrs. Brown,
turning to her younger son, who stood in the doorway listening, his eyes and mouth wide open.
Do you want something?
No. I just looked in to see if you were all right.
Why shouldn't we be all right, dear?
Said Mrs. Brown, touched but slightly mystified.
But William had vanished. He was already on his way across the fields to Marley. William knew the big country house that had lately been turned into a hotel. He walked up its imposing drive, revolved its revolving doors, and found himself in a large hall with its correct complements of reception desk, automatic cigarette machine, lift, and gigantic porter. And here William realised suddenly he'd formed no plan of action. He didn't even know his beloved's name. To demand to see Princess Goldilocks would merely draw down ridicule on him. While he was cudgelling his brains for some plan of campaign, the gigantic hall porter approached him with evident disapproval.
Here, what do you want?
It was clear he didn't consider that William's presence added luster to the establishment.
An idea flashed into William's ready brain.
I've come to see someone what's staying here, he said, meeting the porter's eye unflinchingly.
Who? Said the porter.
For a moment, William was at a loss. He must ask for some imaginary person. Then, while he waited, he could think out his plans. But he couldn't think of a name.
Suddenly, a word flashed into his mind. The name of the only river in England he'd got right in the last geography examination paper. Mr. Medway, he said, triumphantly. The hall porter looked over his shoulder at a man behind a desk.
Is Mr. Medway in? He said.
Oh, yes, he came in some time ago, said the man behind the desk.
William's mouth dropped open in horror. No, I didn't mean that, Mr. Medway, he said hastily, but neither of them took any notice of him. The man craned his neck to look down a corridor.
Oh, here he is, coming now.
Panic-stricken, William plunged back into the revolving doors.
Hardly had he entered them, however, when he saw the familiar figure of Robert standing just outside the door talking to a girl. When Robert was in cash, he was fond of bringing his inamorata of the moment to tea at the Cedars Hotel. Hastily, William pushed the doors inward to complete the circle. By this time, a grim-looking man had entered the hotel lobby and the porter was talking to him, unmistakably pointing out William as the boy who'd asked to see him. With increasing panic, William pushed the door round again. Having done that, there seemed nothing for it but to go on pushing it round.
One exit would bring him out to confront Robert, who by this time had seen him and was staring at him in indignant amazement. The other would bring him out to confront Mr. Medway. Round and round went William, like a dormouse on a treadwheel, faster and faster, as he realised that for the present it was his only means of safety from his enemies. A small crowd had gathered on either side, watching his revolutions with interest. William saw himself spending the rest of his life in the revolving doors, going round and round till gradually he died of starvation. But someone in authority had arrived, and suddenly the door stopped. Robert, unwilling that his inamorata should learn his relationship to the young ruffian, had hastily remembered that teas at the Cedar Hotel were very poor, and that one could get a far better one at the village inn. William, seeing the coast clear on that side, tried to escape to it, but a powerful hand held his ear and dragged him back into the hotel foyer. And there, surrounded by an indignant crowd, he assumed his famous expression of well-meaning imbecility.
What do you mean by it?
Said the man in authority.
By what?
Said William, looking at him unblinkingly.
By going round and round in those doors.
Oh, that, said William. I couldn't get out of it. I mean, we've not got one at home and I'm not used to them. See, it's difficult to make it stop at just the place you want it to stop at. You push it a bit too far and then you've got to go on round again. And every time I pushed it a bit too far and I had to go on round again. The man in authority lost interest in the matter, turned on his heel and walked away.
Is this the boy who was asking for me? Said Mr. Medway to the porter.
Yes, sir,
said the porter, giving William the look of one athirst for blood.
I suppose you're my nephew, Trevor, said Mr. Medway sternly.
And continued at once, without waiting for an answer.
You arrive in a disgraceful state of untidiness, more than half an hour before the time at which I'd asked you to call for me, and then you make a fool of yourself and me over that door.
A child in its cradle could have managed the thing better.
I don't think it could, said William, interested in this assertion. I mean, if it was in its cradle, it'd have had to get out to push the door, and I don't think it could.
Be quiet, said Mr. Medway, testily. Come into the lounge. If there's one thing I detest, it's being the centre of a scene.
Well, you weren't, said William, annoyed at being deprived of whatever limelight there was in the affair. See, I don't see how you could have been, considering it was me that was in the door.
Be quiet, snapped Mr. Medway again, leading the way to the lounge. The porter was still directing the bloodthirsty look at William, and William could see for the present no alternative to accepting the doubtful protection of Mr. Medway. He followed him into the lounge, looking round for possible means of escape as he did so. Sitting down by him on a deep settee, Mr. Medway subjected him to a scrutiny that seemed to increase his disapproval. It never occurred to you, I suppose, to brush your hair, or wash your face, or change your suit before you came to call on me?
No, said William. Quite simply, and without resentment.
I've not seen you for 10 years, and I certainly don't seem to have missed much. Well, how are things at home going on? How's your mother?
Very well, thank you, said William.
Very well, said Mr. Medway in surprise. Well, she told me in her last letter she was no better at all.
Yes, that's what I meant, said William hastily. Didn't I say that? I meant to say that.
You seem to me to be half-witted.
Yes, I am,
said William, thankfully accepting this explanation of his mistake.
The doctor says I may get better someday, but just at present I am a bit half-witted.
Mr. Medway gazed at him suspiciously. Don't you try any of your funny tricks with me, my lad. Of course, I know all your family news by letter.
His ill humour seemed to vanish suddenly, and he smiled.
How's Lucy?
She's very well in a sort of a way. I mean, in one sort of a way, she's very well, and in another, she isn't.
Well, your mother said she was quite well when last she wrote.
Oh, yes, she is, yes. Yeah, I meant she is quite well. She had a cold last week. That was all I meant. William could never resist embroidering a story. And memories of a cold Ethel had caught the week before came to his aid. She went to a dance and got hot dancing and then went sitting out in the garden with the man she'd been dancing with without putting anything over her evening dress. Mr. Medway was gazing at him in bewilderment.
But Lucy is your mother's new dog, surely?
Yes, of course, yes. I didn't know you said Lucy. I thought you'd said some other name. I wasn't thinking what I was saying just for a minute.
You seem to have a misplaced sense of humour.
Yes, said William, eagerly accepting this explanation also. Yes, that's what I've got.
Well, I must say, I look for a little more ordinary intelligence in a nephew of mine. Is Pongo all right?
William's spirits rose. Pongo, of course, could be nothing but a dog. Oh, yes, sir. He's getting on fine.
Feeding well?
Oh, yes. He has a dog biscuit every morning. And some bones in the middle of the day.
Dog biscuit? Bones?
Oh, he has more than that, said William, thinking that Mr. Medway considered the meal inadequate. He has all the scraps that are left on our plates.
Dog biscuits? Scraps on plates? Is that any way to feed a 2-year-old child?
William realised he'd made another bad break. No, that was just a joke. I mean, I was thinking of Lucy.
Well, your mother said that Lucy lived entirely on raw meat.
Yes, she does. Yeah, no, I mean, I was thinking of the dog next door.
The severity of Mr. Medway's countenance had deepened, I must say, he said, that from your mother's account of you, I expected a different type of boy. You seem to delight in making untrue statements. You'll be overtaken by Nemesis one of these days. Well, that seemed a straightforward enough statement.
No, I won't, said William. I'm a better runner than what she is, and I can always beat her. No, we often have races.
She's very well.
Who is?
Nemesis. The girl, what you said, was a better runner than me. I had a race with her yesterday, and I won. William thought it had been very clever of him not to specify any particular relationship with the lady. She might, of course, be sister, cousin, or just a friend.
Mr. Medway rose abruptly. I won't waste any more time on such rubbish. You better take me to your house now. Wait a minute, though. He again submitted William to the disapproving scrutiny. I really can't walk through the streets with you in such a state. You better come up to my bedroom and tidy yourself.
There seemed nothing for it but to comply. Flight would deliver him into the hands of the gigantic porter, who still stood at the front door, thirsting for his blood. Reluctantly, he went up with Mr. Medway in the lift. It was a self-operating lift, the first that William had ever seen. He noticed that Mr. Medway seemed rather nervous in it. Upstairs, in a palatial bedroom, Mr. Medway turned on the washbasin taps and placed soap and towel in readiness. William carefully scrutinised his face in the looking-glass and took out a grimy handkerchief. I think it would do with just dusting, he said.
But Mr. Medway waved him to the washbasin, and William, with the air of an intrepid hero facing unknown danger, plunged his face into the water, then began to scrub it vigorously.
While he was engaged on this operation, there came a knock at the door, and a boy entered. He was about William's age, but startlingly different in appearance. Clean and neat, the shine of his hair rivaling the shine of his shoes, dressed in an immaculate Eton suit.
Who are you? Demanded Mr. Medway.
I'm Trevor, Uncle,
said the apparition.
Good Lord, then who's this?
William had raised his face from the washstand and was watching them through a thick covering of soap suds.
That's William Brown, Uncle, said Trevor. He's a very rough boy and Mother doesn't allow me to speak to him.
The face of Mr. Medway became suffused with an angry purple, and for a moment emotion deprived him of speech.
Then he started forward towards William with obviously hostile intent. William dodged neatly and darted out of the room and along the passage. A large open hamper near the lift seemed to offer a good hiding place. He leapt into it, drawing down the lid, and waited. Soon he heard the voices of Trevor and Mr. Medway.
Which way did he go?
I didn't see, Uncle. Mother doesn't allow me to have anything to do with him. I don't want to say anything unkind about anyone, but he's not the sort of boy Mother likes me to know.
I should think not. Well, if you know where he lives, I'll go and see his father. Neither whom thinks outrageous. I'll speak to the father most strongly, and I hope he'll punish him.
So do I, Uncle.
But I must say, my boy, it's a great relief to find that you're my nephew and not that ruffian.
I'm sure it is, Uncle.
Well, we won't waste any more time on him. Come along.
He opened the lift gate, pressed the ground floor button, and the lift disappeared. William emerged from his basket. He was deeply interested in the self-operating lift. He pressed the button to see what would happen. It so chanced that Mr. Medway and Trevor had just reached the ground floor but had not yet unfastened the gate. They were wafted up again to the second floor. William heard their ascending exclamations of indignation and surprise in time to take refuge behind the lift.
There's no one here, said Mr. Medway, looking through the bars as the lift stopped. How extraordinary.
He pressed the ground floor button again, and the lift began to descend. This time, William, emerging from his hiding place, was on the alert for the second when the lift should touch the bottom. Immediately, he pressed the button again, and up shot the lift once more, still containing Trevor and Mr. Medway. Mr. Medway again peered anxiously out of the bars.
No one here. I don't understand it at all.
Again he pressed the button, and again the lift shot down, only to shoot up yet again from the ground floor. This happened half a dozen times in quick succession, till Mr. Medway's face, glaring through the bars, had assumed a look of pallid terror, and Trevor was sobbing aloud. Then William, who was himself growing tired of the proceeding, let them open the ground floor gates. He felt he was amply recompensed for whatever punitive measures his father might take as a result of their report. He heard the clang of the gates. He heard the sound of Mr. Medway's voice raised in anger and mingling with Trevor's sobs in the hall. They died away. William returned behind the lift again to consider his position. It was not reassuring. He was marooned on the second floor of a large hotel, his escape cut off by a vengeful porter. Suddenly, he heard heavy footsteps approaching. He leapt again into the hamper, drawing down the lid. He'd crouched there in the darkness, in a silence broken only by creaks, for some moments, when he felt himself swung unceremoniously into the air. His head was banged sharply against the basket's sides, and it was all he could do not to cry out.
"Oh, it's heavy, mate," said a gruff voice. "Thought it was supposed to be empty."
"Well, this here basket work weighs heavier than what you'd think," said a second voice. "I've often noticed it."
William, holding his head in both hands for protection, heard the sound of a door opening and the first voice saying,
"Here's the hamper, miss, and proper heavy it is too."
"Nonsense," replied a sharp, feminine voice. "It can't be heavy. There's nothing in it. Well, don't stand dawdling there. Put it down and go." With a bang which caught agonisingly a corner of William's head, the men flung down the hamper and departed. "Ridiculous. Cadging for a tip," muttered the feminine voice indignantly, "pretending it was heavy. What rubbish. Well, come on, we'd better get to work."
"Yes, miss,"
said another voice. There was a quick movement, and the lid of the hamper was thrown back. William, reclining in the basket, his hands to his head, found himself gazing up into two faces. One was that of a maid, the other was that of Princess Goldilocks. But she didn't look as she'd looked on the stage. She looked older and less sweet. Much older. And much less sweet. In fact, every trace of the radiant youth and sweetness that had so charmed William had vanished. At close quarters, she looked elderly and irritable. William arose from his nest slowly and with as much dignity as he could muster. He noticed on a sofa a pile of theatrical clothes which Princess Goldilocks and her maid had evidently been repairing. "What are you doing in that hamper?" said Princess Goldilocks, fixing an angry gaze upon him. William was silent, returning her in imagination to the brigands and pirates and wild beasts from which he'd so often rescued her. "I said, what were you doing in that hamper?" snapped the lady again.
"I was mending it," said William distantly. "I was just passing, and I saw it wanted mending, so I got in and mended it, and then those two men came and carried it away and nearly broke my head off."
"I don't believe a word of it. Show me where you've mended the hamper."
"Oh, just there," said William, waving his hand in a gesture that included not only the hamper, but also the entire room. "You naturally can't see where it's mended, because it's mended, and it looks just like the rest of it. I'd just finished mending it when those men came along and nearly broke my head off."
"I don't believe a word of it," said the lady again, stamping her foot. "What business have you to be mending the thing in any case?"
"I'm employed by the hotel mending things," said William unblushingly. "Yeah, I'm employed by the hotel to go round seeing if anything wants mending and mending it."
"Stop talking such nonsense. No hotel would employ a dirty ragamuffin like you for anything. You're a thief, that's what you are, trying to gain entry to my rooms to steal my jewels. What's the matter with your face?"
"It's half washed," explained William. "I mean, I was in the middle of washing it when something interrupted me and I had to stop."
"You look a dreadful sight. What's your name?"
"Trevor Monckton," said William.
"My uncle's staying in the hotel. He's called Mr. Medway. He's a very rich man."
The lady blinked. If the thing got into the papers, and she liked everything connected with her to get into the papers, she must be sure of her ground.
"Anyway," continued William, "can't stay any longer. I'm very busy this afternoon. Goodbye."
He disappeared abruptly. His disappearance seemed to convince Princess Goldilocks of his criminal character.
"Stop him! Stop him!" she screamed to her maid. "Heaven knows what he's taken! Quick, quick, quick! Stop him!"
They both came running out after him towards the lift. William entered it calmly, closed the gates with slow deliberation, put out his tongue at them through the bars, then pressed the ground floor button and vanished below. Hysterical screams of "Stop, thief!" followed him. William emerged from the lift into the hall. The porter advanced to meet him with the air of one about to deal out a long-delayed vengeance. But when he came close to the lift, he stiffened and stood listening intently.
"Here, what's that?" he said.
Cries of "Help! Help! Stop, thief!" still floated down the lift well.
"Sounds like someone calling for help," said William, with an expression of innocent interest.
It might be a gramophone or some sort of wild beast, of course, but sounds like someone calling for help.
Crikey! Said the porter, and pushing William aside, he leapt into the lift, pressed a button, and vanished upwards. William was out of the unguarded door like a flash of lightning. Like a flash of lightning, he shot along the road and down the field path till he reached the neighbourhood of his home. There he paused, drew breath, straightened his collar and tie, stroked back his soaked spikes of hair, assumed his most effective swagger, and, congratulating himself on having discovered the illusory nature of love before it was too late, sauntered slowly home to tea.
Thank you.